Hello and welcome to the Risk Map podcast, part of the global conversation on geopolitics and security produced by Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy. I'm Charles Hecker, dialing in from London.
And I'm Michael Moran in New York. Welcome to the podcast. This week we'll hear about the launch of the new international anti-bribery standard called ISO 37001, which was designed by anti-corruption experts from 37 countries and apparently no marketing geniuses among them. Nonetheless, this new code could be a significant step toward a global anti-corruption standard.
We'll also check in on the refugee crisis in Europe and how the massive wave of immigration is shaping politics and economics in Germany, which has welcomed nearly a million migrants in the past 12 months.
But first, we turn to Cuba. U.S. President Barack Obama recently announced a further easing of restrictions for U.S. nationals and companies doing business with the communist island, including measures specific to the pharmaceutical infrastructure and shipping industries. He repeated his calls for Congress to lift a decades-old trade embargo, too, but that's unlikely in the near term. Meanwhile, the 2016 U.S. election poses its own challenges. Simon Whistler is our chief analyst for Latin America. So, Simon, from a Cuban perspective, does it really matter much who wins the U.S. election?
I would say no. Through this whole process of liberalization between the U.S. and Cuba, everything has come really from the U.S. side. The Cubans carry on their day-to-day business in politics and in the economy at very much the pace that they want to do. The real change in terms of that relationship would only come after the U.S. has lifted the embargo. And as we know, that requires an act of the U.S. Congress rather than the president itself. And so that still is a little way off. But so from the Cuban perspective, a change of government in Washington doesn't really matter to them either way. Their main priority is driving the human economy, driving Cuban political society based on what their local priorities are. And if there are changes in Washington, they'll watch them with interest, but they won't make any decisions specifically based on who's president in the White House.
Well, let me ask you one more question. What locally in Cuba has been the difference? Has there been an economic uptick? Is there any sense that the Cubans in general are happier or less unhappy with the way the government has handled the relationship?
There have been small differences, but these will take time to really feed down into the system. There have been some tangible changes in terms of the economy. There are more private entrepreneurs, although their freedoms to be entrepreneurs are still greatly limited by the way that the Cuban government controls the overall economy. There's greater access to internet, better telecommunications. There's obviously greater visits from Cuban Americans in the U.S., and that brings in with it a flow of materials and a flow of money that is very important on one level to the Cuban economy. But on the other hand, the Cuban government still maintains significant control over the economy. They're still very dependent on, say, resources from Venezuela in terms of oil and payments in kind for certain Cuban exports. And those have fallen in recent months, and that's caused some economic difficulty. Growth projections for this year have been cut right down to about 1%, and there's been some limited energy rationing on the basis of lower fuel imports from Venezuela as well. So the promise of greater economic growth is still there, but in practice, it's not really happening. And that, as I say, is in large part based on the Cuban government's desire to keep control of the political process. They feel that if they let go of the economy, then their ability to control the political side of things is much more difficult.
Well, Simon Whistler speaking to us from Washington today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mike, since German Chancellor Angela Merkel announced her open door policy last year, Germany has seen the influx of nearly a million refugees. A spate of arrests and attacks there in recent months, some related to migrants, have renewed criticism of Merkel's refugee policy and reflect the complex security challenges facing the European Union. I spoke with David Lee, our senior analyst for Western Europe, about how the refugee crisis is affecting politics in Germany and beyond.
I'm joined today here in London by David Lee, our senior European analyst. Dave, it's been a long time since we talked about Germany, and since we talked about Angela Merkel the last time around, she's come under considerable public pressure over her stance on migration and, of course, has taken a couple of blows in regional elections in Germany. Is the situation facing Angela Merkel as critical as it seems to be from this distance?
I would say that it isn't actually, Charles. No, I think the key thing about Merkel is that she is a political survivor and that none of the threats that are engaged against her at the moment are that significant in the grand scheme of things. Yes, she had relatively negative results in two states which weren't that great for her to begin with, Saxony-Anhalt and Mecklenburg-Vorpommern. And we did see the Alternative for Deutschland, the right-wing party, polling quite well in those two states. And in a couple of other elections as well, did okay in Berlin, for example. But that's probably not going to be replicated on a national scale. I don't think the scale of a protest vote based on the refugee issue and, as Alternative for Deutschland themselves would say, the Islam issue, I don't think a vote based on that is really going to threaten the CDU-CSU's position at a national election, which obviously is less than a year away now.
So then, Dave, it's really up to her whether she runs again for re-election. What do you assess the chances are that she'll be back on the ballot in German elections next year? And as a follow-up to that, what happens if she's not?
It's looking like she is. She suggested a while ago that she was minded not to get involved again. That was just after she won her current term of office. But has kept fairly stum on that since. Now, you can read any number of things into that, but there also hasn't been a stable and sensible succession plan come out of it. The CDU haven't really put anybody else forward, and there's no real challenge to the Merkelian orthodoxy, if you want to call it that. So for that reason, it looks increasingly like Merkel is going to be the candidate. Even the CSU, the Bavarian sister party of the CDU, which spends 4 years out of every five criticizing the CDU chancellor when there is one, appears to be getting ready to stop doing so. One of its vice presidents said the other day that they agree with 95% of what Merkel says on immigration and that kind of thing. So I think peace appears to be breaking out there, as it always looked likely to. So I do think Merkel's going to be the candidate. If Merkel isn't the candidate, then it's a whole new ballgame. Then we are faced with a Europe where we have Brexit, we have new people in charge of Germany and probably France. We have a number of fairly experienced but relatively weak leaders in the second-tier European states. The Rajoy's just won re-election at the weekend. Renzi might struggle to get through his constitutional referendum in early December. Mark Rutte's still there, but you know, who knows if the Netherlands will be able to continue its government through to the end of its term. So Europe starts looking politically weak at nation-state level, which is the key thing, because that's where all the real power resides in Europe. For all the people talk about the European Commission as a vastly centralising thing, it's the European Council that's the real decision maker in Europe, and that's been embodied in Merkel for the last 5-8 years.
David Lee, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chuck. On 14 October, after 4 years of work, the International Organization for Standardization issued ISO 37001, its standard for a global anti-bribery management system. The components of the standard mirror many of the steps set forth in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act of the United States, the father of all such codes, which dates back to 1977. But having a globally accepted approach has long been an anti-corruption activist dream. Brian Mitch is a New York-based partner in Control Risks Compliance, Forensics, and Intelligence Practice. Brian, let's start with this. What exactly is ISO 37001, and why is it important?
So this particular standard is a global standard for anti-corruption compliance programs, or they call it anti-corruption compliance management systems. And so what it provides is a benchmark for companies in terms of best practices for a compliance program that helps to manage and ensure that, or at least mitigate the risk, that its employees and those acting on its behalf are engaging in corrupt practices, such as bribing foreign officials and bribing other potential clients or customers.
Brian, the standard for this globally really has been the ability of the Justice Department to enforce the U.S. Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which dates from 1977. There's always been this kind of reticence overseas to this because it looks like extrajudicial bullying by the United States. So does this give the developing nations and other nations something to hang their head on?
I think the answer to that is definitely yes. I think because it's not driven just by the United States, and also the United Kingdom recently have been active in the anti-corruption space, I do think it, you know, takes away that kind of paternalistic aspect of anti-corruption enforcement that we have seen generally. I think that global aspect of the standard will be attractive to companies operating in developing countries, countries that have historically had a reputation for being corruption heavy or having a heavy amount of corruption risk.
Well, Brian Mitch in New York, thank you very much.
Mike, before we close out today's podcast, let's talk about a few other issues on our list for the next couple of weeks. On Sunday, the 6th of November, Nicaragua holds its general elections. President Daniel Ortega will win the presidential poll, while the ruling Sandinista National Liberation Front will retain a supermajority in the National Assembly. Ortega retains significant support among the electorate, despite periodic outbreaks of civil unrest and anti-government resistance.
Also on Sunday, 6 November, Bulgaria holds its own presidential election. The governing Citizens for European Development of Bulgaria remains the most popular party, and we believe its candidate stands the greatest chance of winning at the polls.
Mike, on Monday, the 7th of November, the signatories to the historic Paris Agreement on Climate Change, which enters into force earlier that week, will meet in Marrakesh, Morocco, for additional negotiations.
And, of course, Tuesday, 8 November, we'll see general elections in the United States to choose a successor to two-term president, Democrat Barack Obama. The tumultuous campaign is almost over, and we believe that Hillary Clinton will be sworn in as the first female holder of that office in January 2017, but with little change to the difficult and divided political atmosphere in Washington. Well, we'll leave it there for this edition of the Risk Map podcast. Join us again in 2 weeks for another update on the challenges ahead in the global business environment. Until then, this is Michael Moran. Thank you for tuning in.
And from London, this is Charles Hecker. Thanks for downloading, and bye for now.